listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Long-Term Care Pharmacy Podcast, where we guarantee that the education will move you to action, just like if you drank a bottle of mag citrate.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the LTC Pharmacy Podcast. This is Tamara Ruggles, one of your hosts, and the other Scott Stewart, and we are joined today by an amazing guest, Laura Herman. So a couple weeks ago, I was working with a family who had a loved one with dementia, and they were struggling with some behaviors and just kind of the next steps on what to do with their family member. And so I reached out on LinkedIn and said, does anyone know an expert in managing dementia with behaviors? And my friend Delon Canterbury immediately tagged Laura Herman, and Laura graciously reached out to help me and was a huge help to me on how to manage, you know, help manage our patient with dementia, but also a huge help to the family that was going through this. So when I met Laura, I thought we got to have her on the podcast because dementia has been on the rise. I know in North Dakota alone, dementia was increased by 7% last year, and we just keep seeing more and more patients with dementia in our nursing homes and our long-term care facilities, and getting to manage those patients that have the behaviors and have the dementia, how to support, you know, the nursing staff and our facilities, and just we want to be an asset and a help to those patients. And so Laura is a great person to be on to help us with this topic. So Laura, if you could please just tell us about yourself, how you got into caring for patients with dementia, and what your business is now.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I kind of stumbled into dementia care when I was about 19. I ended up having an opportunity to be trained as a CNA in a nursing home, and ended up really enjoying it, especially working with the people with dementia. I really liked working with the, you know, the pleasantly confused people. And, you know, we had other residents who were more combative or just had really bizarre behavior. And I wasn't as comfortable working with them. I really didn't understand what they were doing and why. And it just kind of made me nervous. And, you know, there were older, more experienced aides there who really enjoyed these people. And I just really didn't understand exactly why. But over time, I started to figure it out, because these people who I had connected with when they were pleasantly confused, now they were, a lot of them were the ones that were kind of the newer aides were didn't really like working with, because they were so just whatever, bizarre or uncooperative or cranky or whatnot. And to me at that time, it was just so obvious, like, well, she's acting like that because she's hurting, or she's acting like that because you're rushing her, or she doesn't know what you're doing. And so it took me kind of some time to put together all these pieces. I ended up, you know, I have never really left dementia care since then. So I'm going on about the 25th year or so. And in that time, I've been spent a lot of time as a frontline staff member, caregiver. I've done medication administration and activities and care coordination and administration. And then, you know, a few, and I just really love learning about behavioral communication, it's just been an amazing experience. And in 2001, I was able to get in on the ground floor with a memory care community in the CCRC where I was working. And we had an amazing training. We had an amazing team. And what was really cool, we saw some of the residents that lived in the skilled nursing, we transferred them over into our brand new memory care community. And we were, at that time, it was really cutting edge. We were now the social model versus the old medical model. And so we were these people's homes rather than having them just come and work and, you know, come and live in our workplace type of thing. So we really worked really hard to try to essentially get them everything that they wanted whenever they wanted it. We didn't make them adhere to our routines. We figured out what they enjoyed, what they didn't enjoy. We got to know them as people. And it was just absolutely amazing seeing the changes in these individuals. Again, you know, moving from the SNF to the memory care, the only difference for these people were the environment and our approach. And the residents, the change within them and their behavior and their mood and their ability to function was phenomenal. You know, I remember we had one woman in particular was, again, one of the people in the skilled nursing who really nobody enjoyed working with. She was always yelling and making a commotion and not cooperating and hitting and et cetera, et cetera. And in the new environment with the new approach, she was laughing and giggling and bonding with the staff, and the aides adored her. You know, she was functioning so much better. It was just phenomenal. It was such a great experience. And with that, seeing again and again this these transformations of what happens when people have their, you know, essentially have their needs met is what I figured out later. It just continued to fuel my passion and my interest throughout this, you know, like I said, last 25 years of training professional caregivers, family caregivers, whatnot. I did have to step back a couple of years ago out of management because of a number of things. The universe just said, time to move on. And so I took a little bit to pick myself up and figure out what was going on in my life. But what I did with the pieces was put together a consulting company, ABC Dementia, which right now I do work with some business clients, but some of my main focus is right now is the ABC Dementia course and community, where we really focus on appreciating behavioral communication. That's what the ABC stands for. So just that's my biggest passion with dementia care, because it's just so incredible.
Well, thank you so much for all that information. It was incredible and such great insight as you are kind of navigating your journey as you've taken care and cared for those with dementia. We're obviously talking about long-term care today. And in long-term care, we see a lot of dementia residents with dementia. And obviously, we've seen increased focuses from other organizations and especially CMS on dementia care. And so maybe for just a second, as we navigate through this discussion on dementia, let's talk a little bit more about these models. I know for myself, I've seen some models that were adopted by some of the facilities that we service, some nursing home facilities like TIPA Snow's model. I know you just mentioned the social and the medical model, and I appreciated all the insight there. And so let's talk a little bit more about these models of care and what are some of the best models that you have seen for caring for residents with dementia in this long-term care setting?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, TIPA Snow is fantastic. I mean, hands down, she is just wonderful. The best friends approach to Alzheimer's and dementia care was really one of the foundations when we created our memory care. And it's, you know, just built on a foundation of respect and recognizing the person's individuality and all of that type of stuff. And I actually, a couple of weeks ago, had the occasion to kind of look up some of that material again, and it still stands up. It's just still great today. And same with the Validation Training Institute. Their validation method was incredibly foundational to my approach. And essentially, it's just, you know, validating our people's emotions rather than dismissing them. Turns out that's a huge, huge deal. Who'd have guessed? And then another really good resource out there, especially for facilities, care communities, is the International Caregiver Association's Transactional Dementia Intelligence. It's kind of a mouthful.
That's a mouthful right there.
If you can remember it, you can access their services. But the TDI, it's a model of, really focused on how to take memory care communities from the real life challenges that exist today with staffing and burnout and et cetera. How do we change that to create these therapeutic environments and approaches, like I mentioned, in the opening, that were so transformative, not only to, first and foremost to the residents' experience, but, obviously their family members had a much different experience, as well as the staff. Like I said, I worked there for about 20 years, and we had a lot of people who were, you hear a lot about turnover, and that's a huge, huge barrier in long-term care. But when you take care of your staff appropriately, when you train them and you treat them as individuals, as well as your residents, everybody feels honored and safe. The results are just fantastic. And
you bring up a valid point with the short staffing and even the things that have happened since COVID, when we've had to, keep patients with dementia in isolation. I mean, there's just been so many barriers to great, care for patients with dementia, but that's why it's nice to have good tools to use to help with the care, just because they are short staffed. And I think the more effective you are at managing patients with dementia, if you have the right tools, it certainly makes your job easier, even when you are short staffed. So in long-term care, CMS does focus on patients and caring with patients with dementia, but they also focus on antipsychotic use. So what are some of the ways that we can treat, behaviors associated with dementia without having to rely on those antipsychotic medications?
Absolutely. Well, the most important thing to realize, first and foremost, is that behavior is a form of communication, nonverbal communication. And so all humans use it, especially when we, for whatever reason, we can't access our words, whether we're 2 years old and we don't have words yet, or whether we're completely stressed and overwhelmed from our emotions and we're just acting out, slamming doors because we're so upset with, our stupid husband or whatever it is, or whether it's because
Scott never hears that.
Yeah, I never hear that. That's never happened here. So.
That's the thing. That is what I get so passionate about with people with dementia is, there's this pervasive kind of unspoken assumption that people with dementia are different, and they're not. I mean, there is obviously some, it's like people with heart disease are different. Yes, they have different needs and they have different limitations, different capacities, but they are still human. They still have the same human needs. And that is exactly the same for people with dementia. We all have the need for, like I mentioned, emotions, having our emotions validated. No, almost nobody wants to be told what to do, when to do it, how to do it, especially that they have to do something or they can't do something. Pain is incredibly under-recognized and under-treated in people with dementia. And all of us get cranky. We all don't feel good when we're hurting. And some of us get crankier than others, I would say. But behavior, once we start recognizing that behavior is communicating that something is wrong, now we have a way to fix it. Because we have to figure out what's wrong. So the very easiest way to look at this is, if the person is happy and content, they're okay. And if they're distressed or upset, then there's something wrong and we need to figure out what that is. Now, antipsychotics, sometimes, a very small percentage of the time, the thing that is wrong is some kind of like psychotic type activity, a distressing delusion, a really scary hallucination. Things like that, antipsychotics can be fantastic. They can make people more comfortable, more alert, more functional. But obviously that's not typically the problem. And typically the problem is that they're way overused as sedatives, as chemical restraints, even though people try to avoid calling them that. That is what it is. And it's because caregivers, we don't know how to address these behaviors or how to address that underlying need. But again, just remember how you know, how would we feel in this situation? And that can go a long way. So we want to be able to, you know, connect with people. Don't just go in and force them through care. We have to be able to connect with them, communicate with them in at a speed, at a pace, and ways that they can understand what's going on. And when you once you understand how to do that, it is so gratifying. You know, these behaviors, like I was talking about the woman before, it go from yelling and swearing and hitting to laughing and giggling and just saying, I love you so much, sweetie, you know, and that is the difference. So
Laura, can I just interrupt one second for a quick question?
Please.
So when you have a patient, like I had a patient in one of my nursing homes that was continually calling out, and they did try an antipsychotic medication and it didn't help. Is that kind of a good signal that like a psychosis, or that's not the issue? There must be some other underlying issue, and it would be a good time to maybe taper off the antipsychotic and look at another reason for the yelling out?
100%. That is the core of it. Like, it does take trial and error a lot of times to figure out what is the problem. And that's exactly how we do it. Is just, okay, we take our best guess. Let's try this. Either it helps or it doesn't. And based on that, then, you know, if it doesn't help, we're going to get rid of it. You know, so the places that I like to start the pain, like I said, is way undertreated and underrecognized in people with dementia. And it's really prevalent and it's really impactful on people's behavior and mood. So there's a form called the PAINAD, P-A-I-N-A-D, that is really, really helpful in translating people's outwardly observable signs of pain into, you know, the 10-point pain scale. So that is a fantastic tool once you kind of, it takes maybe a little bit of getting used to, but you look at how is the person breathing, how, you know, look at their body language. Are they stiff? Are they pushing out? Are they resisting care? Are they rigid? Are they pacing? You know, you look at their, are they crying or grimacing? There's one called negative vocalizations. I love that one. It covers so much. It covers so much of what is, you know, some of that distressing behavior. And all of that stuff can be quantified then as potential signs of pain. And again, how you tell if pain is the issue is you try an analgesic trial. And of course, you know, opioids aren't the only way to treat pain, but again, like when that's the thing, when pain is the issue, that behavior changes completely. The person becomes more alert, you know, they become more functional, they become less of a fall risk, because what happens when someone is hurting and restless, they can't get comfortable and they can't sleep, like they're going to think more cloudily, they're going to be at a higher risk for falling. So when you find the thing that helps, it's really obvious that it helps. They start doing a lot better and that behavior goes away. So a lot of times what we'll see with pain med trials is that it helps a little bit, but the issue's still there. And that's a great indication that we're on the right track. We're just not there yet. We need either, whether it's more medicine or we need to adjust the timing a little bit or whatever it is, but we're on the right track.
So when you start a pain medication for a patient like that, how long does it typically take until you'll see the result if pain was the underlying factor?
That's a good question. And I think it probably depends on, you know, some of the factors like the types of pain and whatnot, but generally you can kind of look at the half-life of the medication and you know, whatever you expect in an older adult and obviously we start low and go slow and all those things. So, but essentially, if pain's the issue, the problem should go away as soon as the pain does, so.
Laura, you bring up some fantastic points about dementia and the care that we're providing. You mentioned behavior is a form of nonverbal communication, and I think that should just scream out to us, right? We live in such a quick fix society, right? You know, somebody has a behavior, somebody has an outburst, somebody has something, and we immediately jump to that person needs to be on a medication. Oftentimes it might be, in this setting, an antipsychotic or an anti-anxiety med or an antidepressant or whatever the case may be. And to Tamara's and your point, it doesn't necessarily fix that person. And yet then it just stays on their medication profile, and we see this increased risk of falls and other negative adverse effects that come up. And I just think that's such a huge point of we need to be looking at the totality of that person's care, and not just that one behavior means one thing or that it needs to be merited by a med, that we need to dig a little bit deeper, look at pain management, look at some of these other areas where that person may be having behaviors because of those. And then obviously getting rid of those medications that are not effective or not needed on that person is always a huge benefit to them. You also mentioned putting yourself in the other person's shoes. And I think, man, isn't that an incredible point to focus on for everyone around us, but also in this setting of saying, okay, what would this be like if I was in that setting, if I was that person? I mean, if you were to look at me and say, okay, now you're going to get up, you know, I'm somebody that doesn't like to always be told what to do. But if I was one of those residents and I was being told to now get up and now it's time to go and eat and come in here and now it's time to take your pills, you know, I might just get frustrated and throw my pill cup on the floor. I might do that even now and I don't even have dementia. But, you know, I think putting ourselves in other people's shoes is so important for us to understand what they might be going through, or at least to empathize. And I think that then affects the care that we provide, and it creates such a much more caring and deeper care for those people that are in this healthcare setting of long-term care. I want us to kind of move, and I think this all moves us to this final point that I wanted to go over today, and that is support for these long-term care facilities, support for the staff within these long-term care facilities. What are some things that we can do? What are some resources that they can have that can provide support for these nursing home facilities, assisted living facilities, memory cares, et cetera, that are experiencing this care and the need for care of residents with dementia?
It's kind of a tricky answer because it really does a lot more than I'd like to admit, really falls on the management of the LTC community. The aides, an individual aide can be wonderful or can be not wonderful, but even the wonderful ones are limited in really what they can do without management support, without having, you know, that administrator or whoever behind them saying, hey, yeah, no, you have the power, you know what you're doing, giving them the training so that they do know, but then also having their back when they need it. Understanding, again, you know, we all feel and function at our best when our needs are met. So when our staff are coming in, you know, working doubles, you know, day after day after day, or, you know, coming from this job, going to another job, and then going home and taking care of the family, you know, they're not at their best. So we want to really emphasize the importance of that they're taking care of themselves, but also giving them that leeway of, you know, if your expectation as a manager is that, you know, all these people have to get showered on Monday, like, no, that's not going to work. It has to be a system-wide culture change. And so that's not an easy answer that we could just hand somebody, you know, on a piece of paper. Again, I think the TDI method is probably our best bet to like actually get people from here, you know, facilities from here to there. But even that, it's an investment of time and a re, you know, rebuilding out of the rubble, so to speak. So I wish I had a little bit more something positive and easy to say there.
Sometimes I think it helps just to show the people that we work with that are working in the long-term care facilities that we care. Like, hey, like, how's it going today? How can I support you? You know, is it a rough day or how can I help? I think sometimes just them seeing like, oh, the pharmacist actually like cares about my day, you know,
right.
Sometimes that can just simply help, or just offering, can I do an in-service on dementia medications? Can I do an in-service on constipation? Like whatever they might be dealing with at that time, like, could I offer some education? Would that be helpful? Or, you know, just throwing a different offer out there. But I kind of want to circle back, Laura, before we have to let you go. If we try talking about dementia with behaviors, if we try an antipsychotic and they fail that and we realize they have pain, if it's not, you know, the antipsychotic's not the answer, pain's not the answer, is there another piece of the puzzle we can look at, or are those like the two main, you know, ways to treat those behaviors?
No, I'm glad that you asked that. The pain is a huge one, but there's some other really big ones. Depression is also a really prevalent and really under-recognized. And there's a tool called the Cornell Scale for depression and dementia, which is super helpful for screening. And again, it's just based on outward observable signs. So it's actually been proven really accurate as a screening tool, even with in people without dementia, but particularly for people with dementia, it's a great tool. And so in talking about how we can kind of support the care community staff, you know, providing these tools, the pain ad and the Cornell scale, are those two by themselves will account for a huge amount of these challenging behaviors. So depression is a huge one, and it doesn't look the way that you would expect, that you might expect it would look. A lot of times it comes across as irritability and anger, and just things that people, so part of the problem is that we expect, you know, these are even called by the medical profession, you know, behavioral symptoms of dementia. Well, of course she's going to be irritable. She's got dementia. That's one of the symptoms, but it really, really isn't, or at least, like I said, about 80% of the time that irritability can be attributed and addressed effectively by treating, you know, whether it's the depression, the pain. Another big one is grief. And again, putting ourselves in their shoes. If you told me right now, if I just got off the phone with a doctor right now and told me, okay, you have a terminal illness and your cognition will continue to decline and you're going to lose your independence, that is a huge, huge loss. And the way that humans deal with loss, come to terms with loss, is through grieving. And we always equate grieving with somebody dying, but really that's the process in which we deal with life-changing loss. So our people with dementia, almost all, to a certain point, until they reach a point of acceptance, there's a huge amount of grief going on. And again, you look at the symptoms of grief, it looks exactly like a list of symptoms of dementia: anger, apathy, sleep disturbance, irritability, sensitivity to noise, you know. So we need to kind of systematically go through, like, okay, we ruled out pain. We don't think it's that. We think it might be grief. And so we have to kind of look at what's going on holistically in the person's life. Like, what changes have they been going through? You know, all those different types of things. And so it's not a quick process necessarily. And it's definitely not as easy as just giving someone a pill to fix it, you know? But it's really, really gratifying. And again, so the way to really to do this as a system is through behavior tracking. And most facilities do have like a behavior log. And if someone like really gets, you know, hit really badly, they might write something down. But what we want to do with behavior tracking is writing down like every time this person is irritable, even if they're like always like that, we want to start finding those patterns that the, you know, it's always around like after lunch, it seems like she's getting like more irritable. And then, okay, so what's going on? You know, what are there, is there pain coming up at that time? Is there something with lunch? Maybe she's eating something that's not agreeing with her. Maybe she's just getting tired, you know? And so in a care community, especially, you want to really bring in night shift and the dining staff and the activities. And so different points of view to say, you know, she's really been talking a lot about, you know, her husband lately. You know, so we have to like figure out these clues, figure out what's the most likely, try it, see if it worked, you know, try whatever we can come up with to maybe address the issue, see if it worked. And then either it did or it didn't. And then we adjust the plan. So it takes time, it takes teamwork, but it's amazingly effective. It's incredibly effective.
And do you believe once like you find that what's going on, the underlying cause, do you believe that the behaviors will start to diminish, or may there always be some sort of behavior no matter what you do? Or
they will 100% absolutely go away when the issue is taken care of. That said, people are complex and we have lots of issues and are, you know, so it doesn't necessarily mean that once this, you know, that it's a one and done process. But yeah, once you find the thing, and again, pain, like someone's level of pain can fluctuate based on so many different factors. So if pain is the issue, what we'll do in an ideal world is figure out, okay, so this is how she acts when she's hurting. This is how she communicates to us that she's hurting. And so what we would do in our community is actually put in, we rewrote how we handled like PRN parameters, and we would put in specifically like starts talking about her dog Sparky. And like, we would get really specific that like, okay, that's the first thing she starts to do when, and then the next thing is she starts pacing. And then the next thing is she will start like swearing. And then, you know, whatever it is, it escalates. But you get to a point where you can track it down to the earliest noticeable sign. And if you have that documentation to back it up, you can absolutely communicate so much more effectively with the doctors, with the pharmacists, like whoever, to get what's needed. I had a lady who, she was care planned that when she started rhyming, we knew she had a UTI. So that's not something you're going to find like in the textbook, is it? As a
symptom. Right, right.
I wish it was a symptom every time there was a UTI. That would make life much easier.
Wouldn't it? Yeah. Humans are not easy. But yeah, it's interesting. Dementia has always, for some reason, and I didn't figure this out till recently, but interacting with people with dementia has always been kind of made more sense to me than interacting with people without dementia. And I really just recently realized, you know, why that was. And it's really because even though, you know, cognition declines, our intuition, when we get dementia, our intuition enhances. And so we can communicate more directly, just on a different level. But essentially, almost everything that we do in dementia care, when we're really trying to take care of somebody with dementia, it all applies to every human. Like, pay your full attention when someone's talking. Act like what they're saying matters. Like, don't correct them if like they're saying this or that. Just like emphasize the relationship, that trust, that rapport. Like, that's what matters. And like 90% of the things that really are good best practice in dementia care would be best practice in this entire this entire world if we just treated each other that way.
Oh. Yeah, I wondered about that because sometimes, you know, we'll be consult pharmacists sitting at the nurse's station or whatever, and a patient with dementia might come up to me and say, well, where are my kids? I got to get them up and get ready for school, you know, thinking they're, you know, again, 30 years old and they got little kids to get up and get ready for school. But then what's the best way for me to respond to a patient like that? Do I say, your kids are already at school and just kind of play along? Or do I say, you know, you're in a nursing home, your kids are grown. Like, what is the best approach there?
So imagine that you're there, you're doing your, exactly that same situation. You're reviewing the meds, you're at the doing your paperwork. And then you realize, oh, you got to go get your kids. And so you start putting your stuff away and I forgot my kid has a dentist appointment. I got to go get them. And somebody you don't know comes up to you and says, hey, it's okay, Tamara. Your kids are fine. They're all grown up. Like, is that going to help you feel better? Like, no, because that's not true. And this person is clearly, you know, confused about who you are, you know, and you might be polite and say, you know, something, you know, okay, and continue with what you're doing. But, you know, as soon as, you know, they're continuing, like when they're just sitting, pushing down on your shoulder or just really being persistent and getting in your way between you and your kids or something that's really important to you, it's going to trigger this need to handle what's important, you know, in this case, your kids. So you want to answer the question, you want to respond to them the exact same way that you would want someone to respond to you. If that was exactly, you know, if what she thinks is happening, because it really is happening in her mind. So the only thing that's going to help her feel better is to respond as though it is. So if she's saying, I need to go get my kids, then you might say something like, oh, is it getting to be that time? Well, let's see. Okay. I'm going to be going out in about a half an hour and I'm going to be going that way. So let me see, that'll be quicker than public transportation. So, would that be okay? You know, would you mind if I took you there? You know, and so that something like that is going to help her feel like, okay, the situation is handled, and that's going to enable her to actually relax. Now you can get someone to come in and say, oh, hey, we're good. Let's go get ready, or let's go for a walk, or let's, you know, whatever, do the distraction technique. That's not going to work when she's got something important to do. Right. So, the caveat there is you have to be careful about what you say to, you know, because depending on a lot of different things, that individual, it has to be something that's believable within her reality. And you want to avoid saying anything that's outright untrue or anything that's just make her feel like you're lying to her or is going to threaten her trust in you. So that takes a little bit of practice, again, trial and error. Sometimes you do it and it just did not work at all, but just try it again, a little, learn from your mistakes, try it again next time. Talk with the people who know her about, okay, yeah, she's always doing this at this time of day. All right, good. We know that. Now let's address it proactively. If we know that every day at 2:30, she wants to go pick up her kids, we should be taking her for a walk at like 2:15, you know, do something that proactively addresses that need. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. I like the response of, oh, is it already that time? I think well, that was a good response that I wouldn't have thought of, that kind of would put, you know, I don't know if it would put her mind at ease, but it would validate what she's thinking, you know, without me telling her, oh, no, you're 80 years old in a nursing home, your kids are grown. You know, I can see how that would be a little bit startling.
Yeah. Any wonder why she's going to be, you know, irritable and sad and frustrated? Like, of course. But yeah, if you could just validate her feelings, and also what can really help too is sort of tap into those feelings. So that's a clue that she's thinking of her kids. She's identifying as a mother. Let's see if we can, again, we might have to help her relax. If she's got an urgent need, like my kids need me, we're not going to be able to chit chat with her until we help her relax that need is being taken care of in some way. Once we do, let's tap into, like, you know, helping her reminisce about her kids. And we want to be careful about specific questions, you know, something like, oh, how many kids do you have? Or what are their names? that might be hard to pull out those specific points of information, which will probably be stressful for her. She'll probably get all flustered because, like, oh, I should know my kids' names. Well, what kind of mother am I? It's going to be cause a lot of distress. But if you invite her to start reminiscing in a safe way, so you might say, you know, yeah, my kid is, you know, 12 and you know, you shared your story about her homework and that type of thing. So, just opening it up to where you're inviting her to remember, no pressure, no specific questions, but just, you know, yeah, it's a mom's job is never done. Your kids are really lucky to have such an attentive mom, you know, those types of things mm-hmm. that can really, again, we're looking to validate those feelings and help them connect to who they really are, which is not a patient in a nursing home. They're a person, you know, even if they happen to be living in a nursing home right now, that's not who they are. And that's not what's important to them.
Well, Laura, I wanted to go back to the resources again, and to talk about, for maybe there's some family members listening in or some caregivers, or loved ones of those residents or patients that have dementia that are listening in to this podcast. Are there any other resources that you want to highlight for those individuals, or is it the same resources? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the only one I would really emphasize is the ABC Dementia course and community is exactly specifically for that. Is I go out and I just know about a lot of resources. I keep going out and finding more. And so what I keep hearing from family caregivers, you know, who have been doing it for several years, or they're now at the end of their journey. Oh, I wish I, you know, knew this stuff at the beginning. They've had to figure it out on their own in the dark. And so what I'm trying to do here is shortcut that through a, you know, basically relationships. It's just a consistent conversation. So you tell me what's going on. And then, you know, there's a bunch of resources there that you can sort through if you want to. But also you just tell me what's going on and I'll say, well, do you know about this, this, and this? And you don't have to know what to sort through. You know, it's just, we also have a course that helps kind of walk you step by step through this education. But it's not, again, not a one and done thing. It's a process. It's a lot like learning a language, and especially, you know, family caregivers, there's some additional things that are challenging for family caregivers above and beyond professional caregivers, because often they're maybe either the only ones, you know, they're on 24/7. They have some pretty difficult family dynamics and childhood wound type issues, that have come into play sometimes, you know, so there's a lot of just emotional distress. And so we provide a lot of support, just understanding, as well as education and resources and tools, just specific to, you know, your specific situation without bogging you down with everything else. And so that we just, it's like a $25 a month subscription. We're trying to keep it super low cost. And ideally, you know, we're trying to get to people when there's loved one, when their family member is at the very early stages. And the reason for that is because it gets harder and harder and harder to do the more this goes on, the more overwhelmed you get, the more exhausted you get. So the more we can plan ahead and act proactively and get this foundation of understanding in, and then over time, as things come up, you know, we can prevent so many issues if we know about them. If we're just stumbling through the dark, then we're going to stumble into a whole bunch of holes along the road. But if we know where they are, we've got the red cones out and whatnot, it's just a completely different experience. So we do a lot, you know, from the very beginning, you know, what is the goal here? What do you want to get out of this experience? And setting that goal in the beginning is so helpful a little bit later on when all of a sudden you're faced with like decisions about treatments and hospitalizations and this and that. And you're, all you can do is just try to react in real time to, you know, a doctor just, here's a bunch of options, like how are you supposed to navigate that? But through this long-term kind of relationship, and I know what's going on with you and your family, as it pertains to this, you know, we could talk through it and say, okay, well, do you know about palliative care? Do you know about, have you read Being Mortal by Atul Gawande? You know, all of these different things, really, really, really can set it up. Cause it doesn't have, it's hard. It's going to be hard no matter what, but it doesn't have to be the backbreaking burnout that it is for so many people. That's because people are doing it without the right support. And the support is there. It's just hard to know, where to find it. So, right. Yeah, they can, that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Well, you guys, if you have loved ones with dementia or know people dealing with loved ones that have dementia, check out Laura's website, abcdementia.org, and her courses. Find her on LinkedIn, Laura Herman. And Laura, thank you so much for joining us today. I learned a ton. I got a whole page of notes.
I'm right there with you. I got a whole page of notes myself. And I just want to echo what Tamara said. Thank you, Laura, for being on the show today. Such great insight, such great information. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And to all of our listeners, we love you guys and we appreciate you listening in, and have a blessed rest of the day. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.